This Labor and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3456. And Janet, can you give us a rundown, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3456 was sponsored by the Committee on Elections and Rules at the request of Dr. Paul Munier, and establishes conditions and notice requirements under which insurers must offer preferred provider organization insurance. The bill also requires that the insurance offering by preferred provider organizations establish a fair hearing process for providers. There is also an emergency clause on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Scott Gallant and your crew?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. My role today is to actually introduce the other panelists. To my right is Dr. Paul Munier, who had this legislation introduced at his request some months ago. And further to my right is Mike Crew, OMA corporate counsel from the law firm of Cooney and Crew. Dr. Munier will go through the reasons for the introduction of this legislation and how it impacts consumers and others in this process, those who provide medical services. And Mr. Crew will go through the technical details of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Paul Munier. I'm a practicing diagnostic radiologist. I have a outpatient imaging center in Beaverton, Oregon. I have practiced in the state of Oregon for the past 16 years. Historically, physicians have had the ability to participate in insurance products for which they meet credentialing criteria. Health plans and insurers are increasingly using panel participation as a mechanism to manipulate our ability to practice. Under Oregon law, commercial insurance carriers must certify to the insurance commissioner on an annual basis that they have a panel of physicians that is sufficient to provide the services that they offer in their insurance products. This seems to be both a reasonable and appropriate requirement. To be a preferred provider on a physician panel implies that the insurance carrier will pay the maximum benefit available under the insurance policy. In other words, the patient pays as little as possible as long as they see a preferred provider. I think the historically, the utilization of preferred providers is related to an earlier time when managed care had more influence, and there was actually a price differential if you accepted preferred status. That is no longer the case. The health plans set the rates at which they will pay preferred providers, non-preferred providers, in-plan providers, out-of-plan providers. So it simply doesn't have the impact that it once did. The owners of panels operate them as a profitable line of business. Because of the Oregon state requirement for certification of panel adequacy, those organizations, primarily insurance companies that operate in the state of Oregon, have assembled panels of physicians that meet the adequacy requirements. Once assembled, a panel has value. As a physician, I'm required to pay an annual fee to be on that panel. Once on that panel, if it meets sufficiency requirements, it can be rented to other carriers. For instance, out of state requires Cigna or Aetna, would find it more expedient to rent a panel of providers rather than to formulate their own. So they, too, pay a fee to the owner of the panel. In my case, Cigna and Aetna insure employees of Nike and Intel, both of which have a major presence in the Beaverton area. Excuse me. By manipulating participation on the panels, the carriers and the health plans are limiting access to patients. By denying us preferred status, they essentially deny us the ability to see that patient population. Hospital systems and health plans are increasingly in competition with physicians for the services that we provide. They do that by hiring physicians. In my case, they do it by entering into joint venture relationships for outpatient imaging centers, such as the one that I have. I was recently terminated without cause from a major panel within the metropolitan area. That panel controls approximately 40% of all the patients in the metropolitan Portland area. That's a significant part of my business. That's also a significant number of people who no longer have choice in where they're going to receive their health care. Decreased competition and increasing consolidation of control in the medical marketplace results in higher costs of services. Coincident with my termination, the reimbursement rate for outpatient imaging services increased approximately 8.5% on the date of my termination. That rate of increase is established by the carrier that terminated me and is coincident with their opening of a competing center. Oregon is increasingly viewed as physician unfriendly. That is to say, when I try to recruit a physician to come to Oregon to practice, the issue of carriers and insurance panels and participation come up. I currently have on staff a nationally and internationally recognized breast imager, Dr. Bill Eklund, who has spent the last dozen or so years traveling the country and the world teaching others breast imaging. He has been denied participation on the panels. The Oregon Medical Association and the Medical Society of Metropolitan Portland support this bill, House Bill 3456, and they oppose economic credentialing. The AMA and special societies also oppose economic credentialing. If I can quote from a resolution recently approved by the Oregon Medical Association House of Delegates, it says, "Whereas this form of economic credentialing is unethical, predatory, unfair, and immoral on its face, and should be illegal as a matter of public policy, now therefore be it resolved that the Oregon Medical Association supports without reservation House Bill 3456 in the current legislative session. That would provide as a matter of law that an insurer offering preferred provider organization insurance may not deny a provider that is willing to meet the terms and conditions for participation by the insurer the right to participate as a provider for the insurer." Mr. Chairman, I believe it's in the best medical and business interest of the citizens of the state of Oregon to prohibit prohibit the manipulation of medical practice that is occurring by manipulation of panel participation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney in Portland. We're general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association, but in addition to that, For the last 20, 25 years, I've represented thousands of physicians throughout this state in negotiating with insurance companies to contract for health care, managed health care. And I want to put this bill in perspective of the history of how the practice of medicine has evolved under the current contracting system. Back in the mid-80s, when so-called managed care was the rage in the market, the health plans wanted to contract through IPAs to have a broad panel of physicians, and consumers were access to physicians was controlled through a so-called gatekeeper. But physicians had a voice in the makeup of those panels and quite frankly in some of the coverages required under those products, because they could jointly negotiate under the federal antitrust laws because they were risk-bearing agreements. That's all changed. This market has turned completely around, and now it is a PPO type of market. A PPO plan is sold to employers and to individuals with the notion that you no longer have to go to see a gatekeeper. You can go see any physician that you care to. However, if you see a physician in panel, then your copay and your deductible is likely going to be less, substantially less. On the other side of the coin, if you care to self-refer to a non-panel participant, then your copay will be higher, in some cases double, from 20% to 40%. So that's what the consumer faces when they are looking at a panel of physicians. If their physician, their specialist who has historically seen them, is not on the panel, they're required to pay a penalty, a higher copay, to see that physician. And I might add, for no good reason. It's just that the physician isn't on the panel. Physicians can no longer negotiate with health plans. There is a kind of a euphemism out there that, oh, you can come in and talk to the insurance companies about what you will or won't be paid and we'll negotiate with you. But that's simply not true. The insurance companies dictate in this market what you will be paid. It's a take it or leave it proposition. So at this point in time, There is no group negotiation of contracts. The product is strictly price-driven, meaning whoever will accept the least amount of compensation will be on the panel. And utilization is not controlled. Under managed care, it was controlled through the so-called gatekeeper. Now, because the patient can choose to go see a specialist whenever they wish to, regardless of who the specialist is, in the sense if they're willing to pay a penalty, utilization is no longer the issue. Now, the plans rightfully will say, well, but we are concerned about quality. This bill isn't about quality. This bill says that if a physician is allowed to participate as an any willing provider, they must accept the quality standards set up by the plan. This isn't about physicians dictating to plans what their product is going to look like. This is about licensed physicians, licensed providers, and I might add it's not just limited to physicians. If you read the bill, under the definition of providers, it's any licensed professional that is willing to accept the reimbursement and the other conditions of the plan can provide that service without the patient having to pay a penalty. This is a consumer bill as much as it is a bill about allowing access by physicians and other licensed professionals. Back in the mid-90s, roughly, I think it was about 1998 when we finally got the, or 99 when the bill passed, there was a very real problem in this state with the adequacy of physician panels in PPO arrangements. Through the OMA and other members of the legislature, a bill was passed which essentially mandated that these plans have adequate panels. I can tell you as I sat here today that there are many parts of this state that do not have adequate physician panels. I was recently talking to the IPA down in Medford, Oregon, who mentioned to me that there was a very large, well-known insurance company, which will not be named here, which has a PPO product that they're marketing down in the Medford area that had 26 participating providers on the panel. Now, in Medford, Oregon, I would suggest there's closer to 400 physicians down there. But they had 26 of them on the panel. So the people down there in that part of Oregon are going to be paying a fairly high penalty to go see out-of-panel participants. They're going to be required to go see those participants. This bill is simply about fairness. It's about competition. It's about allowing physicians and other health care providers who want to participate on the conditions dictated by the plan to see those patients. And it will hold down the cost of health care. When you take competition out of the market, it's predictable the prices will go up. And some insurers in this state, in fact, are doing economic credentialing with their principal aim, I suggest, to control price and to ultimately increase their bottom line. And that is not what this should be about. It should be about providing quality health care on the standards set by the plans, and any willing provider should be allowed to participate. That's what this is. The bill is aimed at doing. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3456? John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I understand the frustration with the physician who testified about imaging and that sort of thing, and I have followed in the press some issues regarding imaging. However, this House bill is written so broadly that I just wanted to register for the record the fact that we would oppose a bill written this broadly on this issue. Obviously, healthcare costs are skyrocketing, and an insurer's ability to negotiate contracts with providers is essential in trying to hold down those costs. In essence, your health plan intervenes and, in a sense, is your negotiator as a consumer of health care services. And this bill, written as broadly as it is, would undermine any kind of contractual arrangements and thus negotiations for those services.
Rip, finish off for us.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Powell, I have great respect for you. You take on the hardest issues.
There you go.
But if I don't think we're just a hearing today, but in the future, I would like some justification for why, when this gentleman was terminated, that service went up 8.5%. And now you don't have to answer that today, but I would like to have, and this doubling of copay inside or outside the panel, that I would like to hear justification for that cost in the future if we work this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shoffler, and that's fair. The particular incident, I believe that the person referred to does not involve the client I represent. However, and I'm sure that the people who do represent the client could testify. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3456? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3456.
Okay.
And I'm going to open a... let's see, how do I open a work session, on 15?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 15 and committee. The this was sent to the floor about a week ago, I do believe, one evening. and I'd entertain a motion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 15. Representative Esquivel moves that the rules be suspended. And tell me what's the rest of it.
That's for be suspended.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, entertain a motion to vote on Senate Bill 15.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shoffler moves.
Actually, what you need
is
you entertain a motion to reconsider the vote.
Okay. Representative Schaffer moves that we reconsider the vote on Senate Bill 15. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we'll reconsider the vote.
Do I discuss the dash one amendment?
Okay. The on the Senate Bill 15, we have a dash.
Dash one.
Is it dash one or dash two?
Just dash two.
Okay.
Yeah. Dash two amendments that changes one word on the second page. It changes may to shall. And I feel that there was some concerns about accountability. This adds more accountability to the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shaw.
I move the dash ones in the Senate bill.
Dash 2.
Representative Schaffer moves the dash 2s to Senate Bill 15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Your order.
I move Senate Bill 15 to the floor as amended with a B-class recommendation.
Representative Schaffer moves Senate Bill 15 to the floor as amended with a D-class recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Polk. Aye.
Excuse.
Representative
Hoffman. Aye.
Representative Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Do we,
I move to put it on the consent calendar.
Representative Gilman moves that Senate Bill 15 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection?
Please.
Seeing none, so ordered.
Got out of that one, didn't
it? Yeah, nothing. Well, way to go.
Save one for
him. Let's see. Is Deckard here? Yes, I don't see Senator Deckard. No.
He's not here.
He's in Sweden.
Derek's not here to object.
he's overseas.
No, he's back.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Okay, so Janet, we go to. Is Schaffer going to be back? Okay. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118A. Janet, please.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 118, you should have the A engrossed version, and you should have the dash A6 amendments. Senate Bill 118 was introduced at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It responds to a number of complaints regarding homeowner insurance and has been worked on by a group of insurers, homeowners, and the insurance division at DCBS. The bill does define what a loss history report is, and that's on page 6 of the bill. And then on page 14 of the bill begins what a homeowner's insurance policy, what an insurer may not use in an application or renewal for homeowner's insurance. Section 5 talks about how an insurer may cancel a homeowner's insurance policy. Section 6 has notice requirements. And, Mr. Chair, the dash A6 amendments basically rewrite Section 4 of the bill. And the Insurance Division is here to go over the aspects of the policy, but some of the main things are that it prohibits insurers from using information that's more than 5 years old.
Morning.
It requires specific notice provisions about renewals and non-renewals of policy, and it prohibits cancellation of a policy for a first claim under certain conditions, and prohibits penalties for previous claims on a piece of property that were shown to have been mitigated. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Janet. Joel, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ariel, I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 118. It's been a long, arduous process to get to the consensus bill we have today, but I'm proud to say that we do now have a bill that is supported by the department, by the insurance company and agent stakeholders, by the consumer stakeholders, by the realtors, by every party that we've been able to reach out to on this bill. I will, and that's reflected, I think, in the fact that the bill passed the Senate 28-0 back on April 11th. I will very briefly describe the seven key consumer protections in the bill and then be happy to go into more detail if there are questions. The first of those protections is the right to know about the use of claims histories. Consumers have questions about how these databases are put together, are they accurate, and so forth. This bill gives them the right to know about those databases, to correct information that is not correct in the database, and so forth. So it's a very important right to know provision. Secondly, it limits the look-back period on claims to 5 years. The claim can be used against the consumer for those 5 years, but after that, it's off the record in terms of being used for underwriting or rating. Third and fourth, we put some new standards in place for policy cancellations and renewals. These are areas that have generally not been a problem, but when they are a problem, they're a big problem, and so we have new standards in those areas. Fifth, we have a protection for a first claim. If for the first claim within any five-year period, the consumer cannot lose their insurance. They can be surcharged if a company can demonstrate to our actuaries that it's actuarially justified to do so, but they cannot lose their coverage for a first claim in any five-year period. Sixth, the consumer cannot be penalized for making an inquiry of their insurance company. Savvy consumers and good agents already achieve this in the marketplace, but this clarifies that when you make a request, when you ask a question of your company before you decide whether you want to file a claim, that cannot be used against you. And then finally, on mitigated claims, if you purchase a new home or move from your current home to another home and then find out that there's been a claim on that property, in some cases that's led to a denial of homeowner insurance on that property. Sometimes that's appropriate if the past claim hasn't been fixed. But if it has been fixed, and by fixed here we don't mean simply patched up, but actually the underlying condition corrected, then those kind of mitigated claims should not count against the new purchaser. Those are the main consumer protections in the bill. We would recommend that the committee move the bill forward. However, I do have to say, and I just heard this, the amendments were out late enough yesterday that some of the stakeholders have not had a full opportunity to make sure that all of the technical language lines up properly. There's a lot of fairly technical terminology in this bill, and so we would be supportive, if it's the committee's wish, to lean it over for a work session until the next meeting of the committee so that everybody can have a full opportunity to make sure that the DAS 6 amendments do what we intend them to do. With that, I'll stop and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Joel. Any questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Joel, the DAS 6 are your amendments?
Yes, that's correct. There are amendments, but they are also consensus amendments. We've circulated, I think, my legislative guy, Mike Mortar, says 272 versions of amendments on this bill, but they've all been vetted through all the parties. But the actual, literally, the DAS 6 terminology did not come on until yesterday afternoon.
Okay. Follow up. So you've had time, your staff, to review them, and you're comfortable with them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, yes, we did. We literally read them back to what we filed, and yes, we're comfortable with them.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
I have one.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, Joel, this isn't in this bill, but I was wondering in the future if we might think about some kind of a vehicle in order to prevent insurance companies from putting a binder on a house that someone buys and then cancel that thing within 30 days, where we can speed up that process because it puts the new homeowner in quite a position of where they were counting on X amount of dollars for their homeowner's insurance policy and it goes up. And because of maybe a concrete separation or something, and then they cancel that within the 30-day period that they have that grace period. Is there any way we can expedite that in the future to where once it closes, then we have at least a policy for a certain period of time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that's a very important issue, and we had considerable discussion of the issue. The realtors in general told us that they thought the current timelines were functioning well in our market, so we didn't propose a change. We did, however, propose one important new consumer protection in relation to that process, and it may go to the question you have about cancellation, which is the insurers are oftentimes asked to bind coverage very quickly, like on a half day's notice or something when on a closing, and so the ability to, after the insurance has been bound, to go back and make sure that the facts are as described is important to having that expedited binding of a policy. But there were some instances in which during that review period, insurers were then taking account of subsequent facts, say after it's been bound and they're trying to find out whether the facts were as they were on the day it was bound, there's a claim filed. The bill now says you can't use that kind of claim in the check. So what you are checking is whether the facts were as they were described on the date of the binding. So there is that kind of protection in the bill. And to my personal view, I think as we get more and more into electronic communication, we ought to be able to move forward to a more expedited timeline for that verification process by the insurer. But there's always going to need to be some lag there as long as we have situations where somebody brings forward a request for a binding, you know, with not enough time to do the check up front.
Yeah, but we follow up. We may have to go back into the escrow instructions and start that process 3 weeks before close of escrow in order to get the insurance company time to do it, because the house still sits there. They should have that opportunity and have ample time to do that. And if you had a notification 3 weeks prior to close of escrow, they would have ample time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that kind of suggestion was made, and that would take the support of the realtors to say that we're going to get the request in earlier in the process. So it's an important issue. I think we're okay on it now. At least the representatives from the realtors say that the system is workable here in Oregon. But I agree with you that in the electronic age, to have as long a period as we do doesn't seem like it's necessary. It seems like it could happen more quickly. So we will continue to monitor that issue, and if there are any problems with it, we'll bring that issue back.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Joel? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 118A?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company and Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company in Oregon, selling homeowners insurance. Mr. Chairman, I just didn't want this hearing to go by without acknowledging Michael Mortar and Lewis Little Hales from the insurance division. They've been through Hades on this bill, and they drugged the rest of us along with them. It was hot. And I want to thank Joel for allowing the industry to have a day to look at these amendments. We have found in this process unintended consequences of some words from time to time, and that's why these amendments came out as late as they did. But they have been gracious in how they've worked with us, and I just wanted to acknowledge those guys and the department. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to enter a letter received this morning from Osberg to enter into the record in support of Senate Bill 118.
Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 585. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 585 was sponsored by the Senate Committee on Commerce. You should have the A engrossed bill, and you should have the A6 amendments. The Senate vote on the bill was 25-3. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 585A would prohibit insurance companies from requiring their motor vehicle policyholders to be treated by managed care services. And continue a current industry practice of allowing consumers to be treated with doctor or care provider of their choice. There's found on page 2 of the bill. that provision at the bottom of page 2. There's also some clarifications on page 3 about when liens, clarifications about liens, physician and hospital liens. Those are further clarified in the A6 amendments, again on page 3. Just wanted to point out that the definitions on page 1, it looks like they're all new definitions, but the new definitions are on evaluation services, that's a new definition, and managed care services is a new definition, but the other definitions that are in bold are carried over from another provision of the law. So those are not, the other definitions are not new. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's people to explain the amendment as well as the bill.
Jen, did you say there's dash fives and sixes or just sixes?
Mr. Chair, the dash A6s.
Okay.
And I understand there's some additional amendments today.
Dash 4 and dash 6. I don't have a dash 4.
I don't have any.
I have a dash 6.
I don't have a dash 4.
Now we do.
I don't have a dash 4.
I've seen this before.
Okay. Let's see, how do you pronounce this? Doug Barber, please. Okay. Okay, George Oakland. Does anybody want to speak to the bill?
Does anyone care?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sabo. I represent the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. Senate Bill 585 basically clarifies the notion that when an Oregon consumer is involved in an auto accident, they can see the provider, healthcare provider of their choice. The dash 4 amendments that you have in front of you clarify language that allows insurers to have third-party reviews for the appropriateness of the billings and care. Those were requested of us. We're all in agreement of the dash 4 amendments. The dash 6 amendments speak to hospital liens, specifically stating that hospitals can continue to have their liens. The other portion of our bill, in addition to allowing a consumer to see the doctor of their choice, is also does not allow a hospital physician lien to trump services that have been provided prior to the hospital seeing that patient. An example of that is a board-certified chiropractic neurologist. I treat a lot of disc herniation cases, and it's been my experience that we can save 50 to 80% of those folks from having to have spinal surgery. But there are those who don't improve who do require spinal surgery, and there'll be a portion of conservative care that we've rendered. As it stands now, a hospital lien can trump those services. What this bill does is clarify and just simply fairly says that any services that have been provided prior to the hospital seeing the patient must be paid. And we think that's only fair. The dash 6 amendments clarify that the hospital physician liens, that the hospitals can, in fact, perfect a lien. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. John? You have...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, we've worked with Mr. Sabo and his association for several months before the session and trying to come to grips with medical coverages under personal injury protection and auto insurance policies. And last session we passed a bill to try to get some handle on uniformity and billing, and adopted the workers' comp fee schedule as a method of reasonable payment for medical services under personal injury protection and automobile insurance. So we met with the association. They brought a list of issues they wanted addressed, and we agreed to agree on these, and were supportive of the bill. The Dash 4 amendments are important in clarifying the definition of evaluation services beginning on line 8 in the bill to make it clear that medical review record is a review of that by an inside or outside service would not be considered managed care. And again, those reviews review the billings and the services as being reasonable. The A6 amendments are necessary because under the PIP statutes, a person who is hospitalized and receives treatment therein, the providers of that treatment, the hospital and the surgeons, have lien rights, and they can file a lien for the payment of services under the personal injury protection benefit in an automobile insurance policy. And what the bill does is, as Mr. Sabo indicated, is that it says if services are provided prior to hospitalization, then the value of those services can't be trumped or run over by a later lien for medical services provided. And the A6 amendments clarify that section of the statute in House Bill 585 to assure that nothing in there prevents the hospital or the physician working in the hospital from filing those liens. So it's just clarative in nature.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, John, and thanks, Vern, for being here. John, as you know, and I think I expressed in our last committee mandates and so on and so forth, my underlying concern is the rising cost of health care insurance. I know it's a concern of yours. We've had extensive conversations about it. On line 11 of the bill, it says managed care services means any system of health care payment or delivery that attempts to control or coordinate use of health care services in order to contain health care expenditures or improve quality of health care services, or both. Would chiropractic fall under that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, the definition of managed care services doesn't deal with a specific provider of care, but more of a systematic method of delivery of care. What Mr. Sabo and his association were concerned with is in some states there have been efforts, some of them directed by legislative bodies and in other cases by medical providers, of setting up systems of delivery and specifically for auto insurance accidents. I think in Colorado there was a chiropractic corporation that did that. What this says is that those people can go ahead and do that, but what this bill does is that if people can set up any kind of a system they want of delivery of care, an insurance company just cannot require you to go to a specific provider in a system. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Kitts, with auto insurance, it's so much different than health insurance because you may be injured in another state, you may be injured in another community, and the services provided under the personal injury protection benefit of an auto policy are different. We have attacked the growth in the cost of that by the adoption of the workers' comp fee schedule in paying for those services as opposed to trying to manage this end of it.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
I'm reading the summary statement here. It says it prohibits insurance companies from forcing their policyholders into being treated by managed care services, continuing current industry practice of allowing consumers to be treated with a doctor or care provider, and it gives the example of a chiropractor of their choice. Would other forms of, I mean, how broad is that language? And does that include holistic medicine?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, the PIP statute simply says that medical services will be reimbursed at a reasonable cost and now subject to the workers' comp fee schedule if it applies to that provider. The PIP benefit is fairly broadly administered. If it came to some kind of faith healing, I don't know how the claim would be adjudicated. But massage is usually reimbursed.
How about acupuncture?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, it would be under some conditions.
How about like naturopathic medicine?
Chairman, Representative Kitts, it would be under cases.
Mr. Chairman, final follow-up, if I might?
Certainly.
You know, my concern is in the broadening of these sorts of things. You know, we're seeing Tillamook Cheese Factory folks on strike because they're asked to pay 5%. I pay 5%. We're seeing outsourcing of union jobs at the school district. I got a phone call from my superintendent saying we're trying to outsource our janitorial staff because we can't afford to continue to pay the PERS in this case, and it would reduce our cost. Now, right or wrong, there's certain financial realities that we all live in. I'll support the bill, but I think this is something that needs to be addressed. And I don't, if you want to get specific with chiropractic care and because you can show a benefit and that sort of thing, we've got to do something to tighten up the parameters of what exactly falls under these categories. It's no wonder rising costs of health care, when we continue to mandate time and time again, we continue to broaden what's covered. And with no necessarily accountability, I feel. You know, I think these are probably all, I think holistic healing is probably good for some people, maybe just not me. However, I'd like to see some empirical data, you know, on a lot of these things to say this is a viable source. This is good for you. So, and I think that, I mean, while we include chiropractic, which I think is, you know, falls outside the realm of the other aforementioned things that I said. I think those are the concerns that we need to really be focusing on. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Kitts, I think it's important, and to the credit of Mr. Sabo and his association, they've agreed to stay within the confines of the workers' comp fee schedule in
right.
terms of the reimbursement on a per-treatment basis. The limited number of treatments that are in the workers' comp system do not apply in PIP, but the fees for their services are regulated by that fee schedule. And again, to their credit, they have agreed to stay within that. And that's how we approach the cost increases that are coming in that area.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question relating to the A4 amendment, just, you know, for clarification for my own mind, I guess. I mean, I guess it seems kind of obvious, but I'm not really sure it is with the language. When you're referencing the third party medical record or bill review service, is because it says or a third party medical record or bill review service, is that third party or bill service acting as an agent of the insurer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hovely, they would be hired and retained by the insurer. So the insurance company would hire somebody to do that who specializes in reviewing medical billings and that sort of thing.
Right. I guess my point is that you're referring to an employee of the insurer, but the third party called medical record or bill review service is not necessarily listed as being employed by the insurer either. I just had a concern that your intent was that service was being hired by the insurer.
That is the intent.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Don't say any. Thank you, gentlemen, for
Thank
your testimony.
You.
Okay. Doug Barber and George Oakwood.
Good Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Doug Barber here on behalf of Peace Health and the Hospital Association. Speaking to the A6 amendments, our concern, the original bill, as it was introduced, had no impact on us. We really didn't care. But when it was amended on the Senate side, Section 5 of the bill, all of a sudden, we did care. And it has to do, as John Powell mentioned, with lien rights. That's how hospitals and physicians get paid in PIP cases, personal injury protection cases. We found the language in Section 5, that's sub 3, confusing. But when our attorneys read it, they thought that it could be interpreted as taking away and preventing us from filing liens. And so the A6 amendments are just to clarify that in spite of what you read into Section 5 or what you think it says or somebody else interprets it as saying, that it does, that hospitals and physicians still have the right to perfect and file liens under the PIP statutes and get paid for the services that they provide.
Any questions? Don't see any. George, go ahead.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here today representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I will keep my testimony very, very brief. Dr. Sabo asked us to take a look at the Dash 6 amendments in the bill, and I'm here today to basically say that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association supports the bill and the Dash 6 amendments.
And the Dash 4s?
Chair Brown, I'm not here prepared to speak on the Dash 4s.
Okay. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 585? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 585 and open a work session on Senate Bill 585. And Janet, you say we can adopt both of these amendments in one motion? We can.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we adopt the A4 and A6 amendments into Senate Bill 585A.
Representative Holby moves the adoption of the A4 and A6 amendments to House Senate Bill 585. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they're adopted. Mover to the floor. Representative Kipps.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 585 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kipps moves Senate Bill 585 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Gelman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kipps.
Aye.
Representative Shockler.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Need a carrier. Representative Gibbs?
I'll carry it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Is Senator Deckard here? I don't see him. Representative Shield.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to make a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Kitts to vote on Senate Bill 15 if the chair so chooses.
Representative Shields moves the rules be suspended to allow Representative Kitts to vote on Senate Bill 15. Is there any objection? Seeing none, how do you vote, Representative?
No.
Representative Kitts votes no on Senate Bill 15. It was placed on the consent calendar.
Hence the no vote.
Okay, we need a carrier for Senate Bill 15. Any volunteers?
Mr. Chair, there was a motion to present.
I'm not a carrier.
Okay, we need a motion to rescind. It was a motion to place it on the consent calendar, so we need a motion to rescind.
I move we rescind the placing of the 15 on the consent calendar.
Representative Gilman moves that we rescind the motion to place Senate Bill 15 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Send none. So ordered. Need a carrier. No, Representative Holby is on your bill. We'll carry the bill, of course. Thank you, Representative.
Zach, can I have Kitz's questions in advance?
Not on this one.
Committee, we're going to hold Senate Bill 386 over till Friday. There's some amendments coming. And so I guess we move ahead with...
Or do you want to do work?
Might as well do it on 3.
6:30,
start that, and then Decker will come in the middle. We'll probably open a work session on Senate Bill 323. Janet, quickly again remind us of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 323, sponsored by Senator Walker and Representative Brown at the request of the Independent Contractors Task Force. It was a result of that task force from the interim and Senate Bill 232 last session that redefines independent contractor. The definition is mainly on the pages 2 and 3 of the bill. You have been presented at the previous hearing on May 25th a -5 amendment from the, regarding newspaper and broadcast stringers and photographers, a -6 amendment, which is the conflict amendment required by legislative council because of a conflict with another bill. You have -7 amendments regarding travel agents and unemployment insurance. I wanted to point out that the -5 amendments also are about unemployment insurance taxes. And the new amendment today is the -9 amendment. I just want to make sure that you have amendments. The -9 amendment says that if the Speaker of the House appoints an interim committee, the Speaker shall assign to the interim an appropriate interim committee to development of criteria for exempting employees from the definition of employment for Chapter 657. And again, Chapter 657 is unemployment insurance taxation.
Thank you, Janet. Grover Simmons, Roger Martin, and Tom Holt, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Grover Simmons, representing the travel industry this morning. Appreciate being able to comment on the -9 amendment, which it came to our attention only a moment ago. We have some concern about the language dealing with the composition of the interim study group, if there is one appointed, where it says the committee may appoint an advisory committee. The advisory committee may include members from the task force on independent contractors established by Section 7A and so forth. Is it the pleasure of the committee, your committee, to broaden this advisory committee during the interim to include people who were not on the task force on independent contractors? Because my clients were not informed about the task force's existence, much less having a seat at the table. And they've made quite a presentation here, and you're familiar with their problems and their concerns. We'd like to participate if there is to be a committee. The travel industry would like to be at the table. But this could be interpreted as very restrictive language. If the members are to be from this pre-existing task force on independent contractors, that's limiting language. We want it broadened. If there's to be a committee, we'd like to be at the table and get our oar in the water. Of course, we'd like our amendment adopted along with the bill. But if, anyway, you understand what we're asking for.
Let me assure you, if I'm the chair of the committee, yes, you will be included in it.
Thank you, sir.
Roger.
Mr. Chairman, Roger Martin, thank you very much. You were on the original committee. I had faith in, you know, there were only there were several legislators in the committee and several from the private sector, and there was a whole bunch of government types. And I just want to make sure that the story gets told of you, and we have it on record. We want what you just said you do. Thank you, Dave.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I think Roger and Grover have expressed the same sentiments that we have in the concern of the language being limiting versus permissive, and hearing from you that your intention is to make it permissive, then we're just fine with the amendment.
Thank you. Any questions? No, sir. Thank you, gentlemen. Tom Gallagher, would you like to come up and talk to the, say a word to wisdom about the amendments?
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, representing the newspapers. No?
No. Thank you. Okay. Man, a few words.
That's how you get things passed in this building.
The chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitt.
I would move the Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 323.
Representative Kitt moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 323. Is there any discussion? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good bill. I do have some concerns about the Dash 5. The Dash 5s, by the way, deal with the stringer issue.
That's right.
I do have some concerns about how writers are paid in this business, and so particularly in this age of media mergers, I think this is just going to have downward pressure on wages, and I'll be voting no on the amendment.
Thank you. Any other? Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, just I will also be expressing my objection to the Dash 5 amendment. I think the Dash 9 to look into possible exemptions is perhaps a better way to go for us at this point. So I will be voting no on the Dash 5.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Colby?
No.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative
Shields? No.
Representative
Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 323.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 323. And Janet, explain what those are then.
Mr. Chair, those are conflict amendments identified by legislative counsel. Related to another bill, and if both bills pass, there would be a conflict. This does not make a substantive change to either bill, but makes them fit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
I'd move the Dash 9 amendments into Senate Bill 323.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 9 amendments into Senate Bill 323. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 323 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator, you just got promoted. Representative Kitts?
It's not a promotion.
not in our side of the aisle.
That's right.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 323 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On the floor, I'm hoping that my good friends, Representatives Holby and Shia, will be able to explain this downward pressure on these newspaper writers as the wages continue to go up. I'm not going to understand this downward pressure, so maybe they'll be able to explain that phenomenon on the floor.
Any other discussion?
Can I rescind my motion on SB 15? Just kidding.
You can't do that, right?
It's a good question.
Is there any other discussion? Katie, call the roll.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I'm more than happy to carry that bill. if the chair desires.
Thank you, Representative. So Representative Kitts will carry the bill on the floor. And we're down to one bill?
Yeah, and stand at ease.
Could we, the committee will stand at ease for a few minutes. reconvene the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 638. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 638, sponsored by Senator Deckert. It's the original bill. There's not an A and Gross version or anything. The Senate vote was 27-0, and the bill would remove the authority to restore state employees that are terminated or removed from exempt, unclassified, or management services to a position that was formerly held by the employer before appointment to that classification. And, Mr. Chair, that you have at your place a Department of Administrative Services -1 amendments. And Katie Hand engrossed them, so that should also be was also in your packet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Senator, please.
Harvey, you said Senator.
Look at how he's crowding me out here, too. I feel like
there are two microphones there.
I don't know what to make of that. Mr. Chair, good morning. Ryan Deckert, Senate District 14, Beaverton, Alloa, Southwest Portland. This bill, Mr. Chair and members of the House Business Committee, I think is a pretty simple bill. It's pretty straightforward. We have a policy in state government that, and you have my written testimony, that to me just didn't make sense. It requires an agency. If you have an employee, and it's in the management structure, and we know of, I thought 30, but we know of at least 12 cases of this, where you have an employee who's not working out with one particular agency. Right now we have a policy called the restoration policy, which requires that if it's not working out with the employee in this management position with one agency, that they can transfer the employee to another agency, and that agency must take that employee, that manager. Whether they have work for them, whether they have a need, they simply must take them. And so we looked at this in the Senate. It passed the Senate unanimously because I just think it's one policy that just doesn't really make sense. I prefer a model that is more, if there is a need and a job and a requirement, then that manager has it. But if they're not needed, then just like any other sector in the world, we would not continue to employ that individual. And so that's how you have Senate Bill 638. I think it's a really good idea. It's not land-breaking, but I think it would save the state certainly hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, in terms of just unneeded folks that are occupying positions that there really just is not a demonstrable need for that individual. I could go on at length, but I think that basically gets at it.
Senator, if they transfer that person to another agency, does that agency, are they obligated how long they have to keep that individual employed?
Mr. Chair, the instances that I'm aware of, they still have this employee and are not able or have not been able to, though there is no definable position or job for the individual, they still have the individual employed and paying the salaries. And this is, we're into more than months, into years. And to me, that's just, it's just not a rational way of doing business. And Harvey from AOI, I could probably indicate that not a lot of private sector firms would have that policy in place, and I don't think it's a good policy for the state.
Representative Schoenfer.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. No private companies would. And I agree conceptually with what you're doing. The building trades, if there's no work, you go home. And you don't say, I need more money to keep my job. You just go home. And then you go on unemployment or you go to the next job. Would it be wonderful if it was so easy here? My concern about this, Senator, and I agree with you, somebody shouldn't be sent back to just sit around and do whatever and get paid. That's wrong. And we got the money to do that. The concern's been voiced to me is the way the bill's written, and I don't know if we're going to change it or not, is you get some classified worker who moves up into management, and then they can never go back if they say, well, I'm sick of management. I'd rather just go be a peon, and that's looking pretty good all the time from this chair. So that's my concern here, that we restrict the ability for that individual to go back and work as a classified worker and just go about their daily job. And that's my concern with this bill right here.
It looked like he's ready to respond.
If there is work there to be done, I'm not suggesting that we... You see where I'm going
here?
Yeah,
Mr. Chair, my only response is that then that individual, and maybe it's just a personal philosophy that at-will employment is a better arrangement instead of guaranteeing certain jobs for certain people. And but I guess my only response is you're right. You could have those examples. I think we're talking about a relatively few folks, but if you did have that example of a classified employee who did a great job, moved up into management, I guess the response would be if it didn't work out, my hope would be that they'd reapply to the job that they had, and since they were so good, the agency would want that person back in that classified position or another similar classified position. But I'd prefer a world where there are less rules about this position is protected here versus this one there, because I just think you'd get a better, more efficient environment if you had more free flow and actually allowed managers the discretion to hire and fire people.
Let me follow up the brief Chair. And there's another concern that it'll discourage. I did say I think, believe may I. Mr. Representative Kitts is now teaching me manners.
Oh, boy.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, half an hour later. I'm also concerned about it discouraging folks from moving up, thinking... And Rep. Senator, believe me, I agree. There's no guarantees in life. Obviously, our jobs aren't guaranteed, and that's a good thing. And I think we need to get away from any kind of I'm entitled to this job kind of attitude, because that's, if you're not doing the job or you can't do the job or there is no job there for you, then you shouldn't get anything. But one is the flexibility, getting rid of flexibility, and a broad sweeping statement of policy doing that, and discouraging classified workers from considering or moving up into management. And those two things I'm concerned about. So.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, I think, Senator, I think maybe the key to this is the policy of existing policy. And what I mean by that is that if we had a policy where, okay, I'm a protected worker, they ask me to go into management, the Peter Principle comes into effect, I cannot handle the job or I despise the job, one of the two. Shouldn't we have a certain period where I can go back to my other job and bump back? Wouldn't that clarify this? I may be doing a great job where I'm at. And I'll tell you what, if there's a department out there that's trying to schlep me off to someone else because I'm not very good, that's a different issue that we need to address. But you see what I'm saying? My concern is, why would I, as a classified employee, want to move up and take that chance?
Maybe it's philosophical to me. I mean, and I think it does get back at when I met with Dash yesterday, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Escobar. To me, it's just in the real estate industry. And you would be more of an expert on this, Mr. Representative Escobar, than I would. But if you decided to take a position, a different position, I don't know that you would be, although you could tell me, guaranteed access back to the old position that you left. And I'd like state government to operate in the same vein. And then the individual can make clear decisions. Should I leave my position I have right now and go to this maybe better, higher-paying position with more responsibility, or should I stay in the one that I have? And it's just, in some ways, I guess, philosophical. I know that DAS does have a Dash-1 amendment, which I just heard about late yesterday, so I'm willing to look at it if it would make the policy work better. But I think ultimately my position is that I'd rather try things without this restoration policy in place and see how it goes, because I just think it's one of those things that you come across, and that was certainly the experience we had in the Senate, is you got a unanimous vote because the more folks really looked at this, they thought, huh, this just doesn't make sense that you would have these type of protections in place when we're trying to get schools and human services and universities funded. There's just a better use for those dollars.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
First of all, I support the bill and I support the amendments and applaud you, Senator, for bringing this bill forward, and applaud the folks at AOI and those that have helped you with this bill. I think in response to some of the questions that have been raised, I think it's comparable to say if you're a state senator and you're going to take the chance and run for a different office, and at that point you say, well, you know what, I really didn't want to run for Secretary of State. but I want my Senate seat back. You know, you take that chance. And now you could go before the voters and run again, and you have that option. They may or may not, if you did a good job, and you know, in your district, they probably would take you back. And now, granted, elections are different from hiring, but it's the same scenario. If I'm currently doing a job and I decide to go for something else, well, you know, once you leave a job, you shouldn't be guaranteed to have that job back. I would agree fundamentally with you on this bill, and I would hope the chair would move it forward.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or if you wanted to run for Secretary of State, I didn't mean to leave you out.
I'm happy with my job.
Okay.
Only if you run, then I'll run against you. Anyway.
I'm not running against Ryan.
I worked in a packing plant and a washing machine factory. And if you had seniority, you could move into one job and you could bump somebody that didn't have the same seniority. Is that what's going on here? Is this a seniority thing? Okay. The union folks are nodding their head. No. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Harvey, did you have testimony?
Sure.
Just there to answer your question.
I'm Harvey Matthews with Associated Oregon Industries. I want to thank you for hearing this bill and thank Senator Decker for bringing it forward. I think it's pretty simple. It's if you read the DAS policy to my board of directors out loud, it would go over probably better than Chris Rock monologue. It's that funny. So to simply support this bill without the Dash 1 amendment, I think is the best strategy going forward. It improves the business sense of our state government, and we strongly support the Senate Bill 638 without the amendment going forward. Thank you.
Okay. And Senator, you said you hadn't seen the Dash 1, so
yeah, and we're taking a look at Adam. I'll stay for the Dash testimony, but I think my position would be similar to Mr. Matthews. I wouldn't want to read a Chris Rock monologue to his board of directors, but to me, this policy just is one that I'd be willing to live without, and maybe in 2 years, if it just simply is not working, we could revisit it, but I'd like to take the chance of not having what looks like arcane language to me on the books and see how it works that way.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for your testimony. Mary Bodkins, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we're not actually very sure about what this bill is trying to solve. You know, let me just tell you a story about a manager who was a very good manager, and he worked in the Department of Corrections, and he was the head of one of our, well, he actually doesn't work for state government anymore, so I guess it's okay to talk about him. He was the head of the training department for the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections had need of a new director, so they brought in a new director, happened to be the Multnomah County Sheriff, and the Multnomah County Sheriff also brought along with him his executive assistant. The executive assistant and the training manager did not get along. The training manager was fired. And after 2.5 years of litigation, finally got his job back. You know, if the manager had just stayed in training instead of taking on the management position, he never would have been at risk. We think it makes sense to give people an opportunity to spread their wings. We have collective bargaining language that allows our members to leave the bargaining unit, become management services, and return to the bargaining unit, to their former position. And at that point, yes, seniority does play a role. Because we think that people ought to be given the opportunity to try new things without jeopardizing their career. I don't know about executive services, but I don't know of any manager who's ever been moved back into a non-vacant position. They have been moved back to their agency of origin. They have. I've never seen one just sort of moved into a position, you know, kind of create a job situation. You know, we don't have very strong feelings about this one way or the other because we're covered by our collective bargaining agreements and our members are covered by their collective bargaining agreements. So if they move up into management services and it doesn't work out for them, they have the right to bump back into the bargaining unit and retain their seniority. That makes sense to us. I don't exactly know what the practical effect of this bill will be. I'm pretty sure it won't get rid of the managers that are on our list of people that ought to be gotten rid of. You know, I'm pretty sure that it's not going to stop people from moving bad managers around, you know, the larger agencies. I've never been able to figure out a way to get a manager fired. But, you know, clearly this is a problem from somewhere. And I have a suspicion that probably this is a bill that has somebody's name on it that other than Senator Deckert's. And I don't know who that is, and I don't care to know. But, you know, I just don't know that there's a huge problem out there that needs a law to address. Rather, maybe policies and rules as to how DAS functions is the appropriate place to handle this.
Representative Schoenfer.
Thank you. You know, if somebody can't or won't do their job, they should just be let go, even if it's...
Termination comes to mind.
On Christmas Eve with their new baby in their hand, God forbid. But, you know, I'll tell you, is this going to... I know you. I haven't studied this. Maybe the senator can answer this. Is this going to conflict with collective bargaining agreements?
I think collective bargaining agreements always supersede state law. We have the ability, we have the right, the legal right to always bargain better than law.
We're getting the answers. I mean, and Mr. Chair, just for the record,
that's why they have administrative law judges.
Yes, very briefly, Mr. Chair, conceptually, I agree with the senator that if there's no place for them, I'm sorry, that's too bad. I didn't make it that world, but that way. But that being said, as you just stated, if there's collective bargaining agreements in place, which I'm rather fond of those, I think we need to make sure those are not violated. So I feel strongly both ways. I don't know what more to say. So,
Representative Kitts.
I agree with everybody. The analogy that comes to mind is it's like kicking a bird out of the nest to fly. But in fact, if the bird can't fly, let's make sure that we have a parachute and a way back up into the nest if in fact that doesn't happen. And quite frankly, that's not the real world. It may work that way with AFSCME and you folks in your language, but it's not the real world outside of that world. It applies to a select few, and God bless them if they can get it. But that being said, I would also just ask, Mary, that you take caution with comments on the record about senators' intentions or who's behind a bill, because it says only Senator Deckert, not at the request of anybody else. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I stand corrected on that. You know, it's just been my experience oftentimes that there is some kind of a... individual experience.
I understand.
Any other questions for Representative Holden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to clear this up for my own mind because now I'm not really sure what this bill does specifically, but I'm curious if in fact there has been an employee that's moved up into management from the collective bargaining unit and now is in management services and for whatever reason isn't working out as management material, does this bill forbid the state from reemploying him back into his classified position?
Mr. Chair, I don't... Representative Holby, I guess that's my question. I don't know the answer to that. And understand, there's a lot of different areas where you can move up. You know, in... you know, in the Department of Corrections, you can move from a sergeant, which is a covered, is a bargaining unit position, to a lieutenant, which is a non-bargaining unit position, and oftentimes a lieutenant just simply, I mean, they find out they just don't like that position, or they don't want Maybe. That much responsibility, and they'll move back to a sergeant position.
Maybe.
you know, I just don't know. Right. I don't know what this
Not
bill does.
A requirement.
You know, and that's why, you know, we signed up as neutral. We really are neutral on this bill. We don't know what the bill does. We don't know what the problem is that it seeks to solve, and we don't know of any practical experience with somebody leaving management services, going to the executive branch, and then moving back. We just don't have any practical experience with that in our units. And so we're sort of trying to figure out what the bill does. We want to make sure it does not adversely impact the ability of our members in the more paramilitary environments that we represent, from moving up and moving back if it doesn't work for them. Because we think that they should be given the opportunity to move up within their ranks, but not have to give up their career to do so.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I was hoping maybe Das can answer that question for me, because my concern is that, because I've seen it happen oftentimes in private industry, where we have somebody who moves up from being a foreman in the construction industry to being a superintendent, but then just can't handle the job and is yet an excellent foreman, and so the company would move him back into that position. And I'm worried that this bill will forbid that from happening, maybe not at the executive to management level, but from management back to a classified position. I don't know if this bill eliminates that ability for the state to do that or not.
And that's my only concern, too.
President Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Holvey brings up a good point. Every bit of the language in the bill is permissive. Every bit of it is may.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them the opportunity. And I would think, under the situation that Representative Holvey just spoke of somebody going from a foreman to a superintendent and not being successful at the superintendent, but if they were, and I think Representative Schaffa gave the same example, if in fact they were a good foreman, why wouldn't they be hired back? Well, you know, hey, you know, you didn't, but it doesn't guarantee that you get to go frontwards and backwards. It's permissive, is the way I'm reading it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing the dialogue. But, you know, I'm looking at the staff measure summary and also Senator Decker's testimony, and it clearly says this removes the option to restore a terminated or removed state employee. I mean, that doesn't seem very permissive to me.
Any other questions, Mary? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'll take my leave and allow Das to explain the bill.
All right. Could we have Susan Wilson and Laurie Hammer, please? Or Warner. Or one of those, yeah. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Wilson. I'm administrator of the Human Resource Services Division at the Department of Administrative Services.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lori Warner, the acting director for the department. I spoke with Senator Deckard about this bill yesterday afternoon. That's the conversation we had. I'm going to let Sue go through the bill with you and explain what it does, because I think there's enough confusion here for everyone probably about what it does and what it doesn't do. Just briefly, I've been in state government about 20 years and been either in a director or deputy role for four agencies. And so I have experience with these people coming back down into the organization. And after Sue explains, I think, what the bill does, perhaps we should have that conversation about what actually happens and takes place across state government. So, Sue.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have had a chance to talk with most of you about the bill, and I think the questioning has been really good to help me clarify maybe where we need to get some points to specify here. Again, under current law, we have the three levels of service. We have executive service employees, who are the agency heads in the top level. They are at-will employees, can be removed for any reason or if there's a change. We have management service employees. And under the current law, which this bill addresses, there's two ways that an employee can be removed from management service. One is for cause, and that is the list that's in the statute, which basically is the person is not just working out. The person has problems. The person is it's malfeasance, it's insubordination, it's those issues where the person shouldn't be in state service. In that case, when an individual is removed, they are gone from state service. There's no restoration rights for individuals removed for cause. However, if you have the situation, which Representative Holvey gave an example of, which I think is a good one, we don't have quite the same kinds of jobs, but if you move from the foreman to the superintendent position, and you're in different agencies, we are all one government, one state government, as a company would be one company, you then were apparently in good standing where you were and got good references when you came out of that position. You move into the higher level position. For whatever reason, it isn't working. You may not be cut out specifically for that job. There may be elements that don't work for you. We then, if it's not one of the cause reasons, if unable to perform that, then you have restoration rights back to the agency and the level of position where you've been. The question always, and it has come up here again, well, what if there isn't any work to do? It is up to the agency to manage the resources that they have. If they have an individual, if they have a workload that goes down, then they need to get into a layoff mode. And if there is no work to do, then the individual should be laid off. And that is possible, and that is under the law, and is what can be done to manage the workload. There is nothing that says you have to keep an employee forever. If there is no workload, you go through a layoff process. What this bill does is take away that second piece. It takes away the fact that you can be restored back. And that's the issue that we have. We would like to maintain the flexibility to be able to restore individuals if they are removed because they are unwilling or unable, give them the opportunity to go back where they were. In the vast majority of cases, these individuals are assimilated and are productive in the agencies they go back to.
For clarification, it does not take away, as I'm reading it, one's ability to go back to a position that they once held. It takes away the right. So it becomes permissive. They could go back, and if the position is there or there's a position similar, they could go back. It just takes away their automatic guarantee, if you will, to be able to go back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, there are elements within state government that make that more difficult. If you're a private corporation, you can say, look, this one isn't working out here. We're just going to put you over here because we think it's a better fit. We have both collective bargaining and we have policies related to competitive aspects of getting a job. Just to say, I'm going to take you from this agency because I know it's not going to work, I'm going to pop you over here in this agency because we know there's a need, isn't necessarily something we can do under our policy. We are restricted by... You go through competitive processes to fill positions. This allows you the flexibility. And, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, you also mentioned the permissive aspect and the may in the law. What's happened with that may in the law is that the courts and the Employment Relations Board have, in essence, ruled that's a shall. We have had situations where we have not put individuals in two positions saying it's a may. They have gone to ERB, they have gone to the courts, and the courts have said you will restore that person. That is something that is there. So we're working under a body of law in addition to the statute.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. Just because the courts have ruled that may in that particular case shall be a shall and ruled on the side of the other doesn't mean the courts are interpreting it always definitively the may shall be a shall, because I think if that were the case, then it would have been written that way. So whether or not they've ruled in a specific case that in this instance you will do this, because one side may or may not be wrong, or may in this case be wrong, and say you'll do this, it still gives the flexibility as opposed to even being able to arbitrate it in front of an administrative law judge with the ability, if it said shall, it would be a definitive, it'd be done, mm-hmm. You'd have no need. But being that it's a may, that's where you go argue your case, and then if the judge at that point says shall, then he obviously ruled against and determined that you probably shouldn't have done a May in that situation. So I don't think the example that you gave of a specific time that happening supersedes the permissive nature of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitson, I you know, won't get into the legal arguments. There have been numerous cases, and we work with our Department of Justice attorneys on this, and that is the legal advice that we operate under.
Susan, if we pass this bill, the state of Oregon wouldn't be able to demote a person to another job. As Representative Holvey said, that he had a project manager here, and the person wasn't doing the job, so they demoted him and moved him over to a foreman's job here. They wouldn't be able to do that?
In essence, if the bill passes in its current form, it takes away the option to be able to say, we're taking you out of this one, and you're going back to where you were before. There would have to be people would have to go through other processes to, again, someone talked about find a different job or work whatever, but it would take away that option of actually restoring the individual where they were.
Even if the person agreed to it?
Even if the person agreed to it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitt.
I'm curious, because that's where I'm having the disconnect, is because I'm not reading the bill that way, so I'm wondering, can you tell me where in this bill it says that if someone is promoted, and I'll use Representative Holvey's example, if someone is promoted to supervisor from foreman or from A to B, and if B doesn't work out, that this bill in any way prohibits that person from being able to go back? It just simply, from my understanding interpretation, it doesn't guarantee that person the ability just by acclimation of, hey, you screwed up this job or you're incapable of doing this job to the performance levels, we're just going to send you back now, or that have the right to go back. But it doesn't prohibit you from allowing that person to go back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, as I indicated, there are other issues associated with that. We do not have the ability to just take someone and move them from one position and say, you're now going to go back to this other position. If you're not working out here, as you indicate in that situation, an individual could apply for another job in another agency, and they could move to that other job. But we do not have the ability to simply take someone from one agency and say, you're now going into another agency. There's an application process. There's a full process. Absolutely. If something's not working out and an individual chooses to apply for another job or take a demotion and apply for a demotion, they can do that. They can apply for a job and transfer to another agency. But there is an application process, and they have to go through the competitive process to get there. We believe that in some of these situations, if these people are being productive, we should be able to maintain them in state service. And if they were doing a good job where they were, to let them go back, to have them go back. And again, this is a fairly rare situation to occur. We have maybe right now, I did a survey of human resource managers. We talked to agency heads. This is not causing them consternation. This is not a problem for them. And I found that probably over the last 3 years, there's maybe been a dozen people who have been restored to agencies. Those agencies have not had problems having those people come back with the maybe one instance where there was an issue with an agency. But for the most part, agencies like to be able to have this flexibility to know, I'm going to take somebody back, and, you know, if something works out the other way, the person may go the other way also.
Can I have one final follow-up? So, an example, if somebody's working in an agency and gets assigned to a temporary director of that agency, would that director, if they weren't kept on as permanent, be able to go back to a position that one held prior?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts,
just a hypothetical.
Well, I've been in that situation
exactly.
Several times, and I think people moving out of management service, which is you know, the case where a lot of people promote up from classified into management, and then if you ask them to take on an executive director role, for example, or a deputy role in an agency, without this provision, they would not have restoration rights back to their management job. And that is one of the issues in terms of working with agencies. If you look around state government, you'll notice that agency heads, you know, for the most part, serve anywhere from 8 to 10 years as kind of a maximum range, but many of them change over more frequently than that. If you look at the Department of Human Resources job, those kinds of jobs. So you've got people that you ask to step up from management service into those roles, promote into them, and they then look at the management team underneath them when they get at that agency, and they ask some of those managers to leave, and that is in most instances, at least that I've been involved with, where you're wanting to make a change in the agency and you're going to then move managers out of roles back to other roles so that the new administration can actually bring in other people that they want. Now, that doesn't mean they were doing a poor job. That means the agency director retired or left, change in venue, maybe a different strategy. You need different players. And so those managers that were there before are asked then to leave and restore to their old agency that they came from. That's some of that, where some of that change out happens, and the ones that I have seen occur. There would be no guarantees, and I think there's issues of asking management people that are long-term state career people to step up into executive roles without anything there. Many would not choose to do that because they want to serve out their career in state government, and the risk is too high. And Senator Deckard and I had that conversation about how public sector works a little differently than maybe private sector in that respect. Maybe folks aren't willing to take those kinds of risks. They're in public sector perhaps for some of those reasons.
Do any of these people that are being moved around have any kind of bumping rights?
Mr. Chair, the bumping rights really has to do with the classified service and people bumping within there. When you get to management service and executive service ranks, that concept of bumping rights does not exist. The only thing that we do have is this particular policy that is statute, by the way. It's not DAS written policy. It's legislative statute that was passed and has been as part of the fabric of state government for many years. And as Sue indicated, it's not been a huge number of people that have used that particular tool that we have used that particular flexibility with, but there are individuals that have been affected when you turn over the top ranks of state government, and when sometimes, as Representative Holvey suggested, people move into roles and then find, gee, this wasn't a very good fit for me. I wanted to try it, but I don't think I want to stay. And then they go back. State government managers in large part would be very concerned if they thought that we weren't using the resource well and making use of the people that we have on staff. So the vast majority, I think, is the case that has been a tool that's been useful for state government and for managers in state government.
Representative Shoffley.
Thank you. I think it was said earlier, and you know, I've vacillated on this issue in light of what I've heard here today. I especially have a problem with the courts in a lot of areas. I agree with them in a lot of areas. I don't. But to say may mean shall, now you know what? I disagree with them on that. That's just wrong. I mean, it's like saying, well, Mike, you said this, but you meant that. Well, you know, I hate it when people say that because I don't agree with that kind of thing. And the union representative, Mary Botkin, said that the collective bargaining supersedes statute. So even if we pass this, I don't see how this is going to... We could create a conflict, but if she's accurate, and I'm sure she'll fight like the Dickens to prove she's accurate, then I don't see how we're doing a problem, where the problem is here. And if there's no bumping in executive and managerial, but if you descend back down in, then... Does your seniority take effect again? Do you maintain that seniority? And then you leave this position classified, you go to management, your seniority stays intact there. They fill you in with fill in your spot with somebody with less seniority. You come back in, then you then the bumping right does take effect anyway, according to collective bargaining. So I don't see what this bill is really going to do if we do pass it, which I'm inclined to be quite frank with you, just to see what happens.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting. Mr. Chair, Representative Schlaffler, on the collective bargaining issue, I think that is one where we do have questions, and chances are it would probably end up in some sort of a legal situation, because our collective bargaining contracts right now currently have a provision that says if you are a represented employee and you take a management position and you are removed not for cause, so if you're removed for cause, all bets are off, but if you're removed not for cause, in our contract language, you will come back into the agency and a comparable position to where you were before. If we pass this law, which says you cannot restore an individual back, then our collective bargaining agreement as it is right now is probably fine. But as soon as it expires, chances are we would be getting legal advice on whether or not we can, with a collective bargaining contract, trump state law. And we would have to bargain it at the very least to get there. So there is some real question in terms of, because of the language that is being removed in Senate Bill 638 that says you can go from classified to management and you may restore if you're removed for some reason other than 245.55, which is the cause statute, then it takes out that restoration capability, and what it would mean to collective bargaining contracts is really unclear.
And Mr. Chair, please.
Call on.
Could you find the line on the bill that says you cannot restore an individual in out of an example like that? Where in this bill does it prohibit that individual from being restored?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schlaffler, no, and I appreciate this, and it gets very circular.
Yeah.
The only authority we have to restore is in this first paragraph. Other than this, we do not have authority to say, I'm going to put you in a position, regardless of any other policies we have about our hiring and appointment practices. We have other statute and policy and collective bargaining contract that says, here is how you fill a position. And it is not, you take somebody from somewhere else and pop them in here.
Mr. Chairman, and I think that gets to the crux of the argument as to whether or not you should or should not be able to do that. For example, if someone goes up into management and doesn't work out, the contention is that they have the right to just go back and not have any set of standards, just get placed. And whether or not that's a good thing, that's a debatable issue. But what this bill does is it takes away that it's an automatic right. It does not forbid, as Representative Schlaffler pointed out, does not forbid you from being able to bring back that employee. Now, it may change the mechanism by which, for example, if they go to superintendent from foreman and they don't automatically have the right to go back to foreman, which you're taking away that right, they do have the right to apply for that job and go through the process. And I would assume that if they're the most qualified person, which is what we all want, is the most qualified people to do the job, they'd get hired back. Is that scenario not accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, it could be. It may also be.
It shall.
It's a shall. No, it's a may. I think the issue here is because agencies very often are very tight on resources and there may not be a position open at that particular time. There may not be that same job that they came from specifically.
So if the position's not open or that job's not there, and they do have the right to go straight back, are you then going to make a position for them or create a position for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, that's part of the ability of the agency to manage their workload. Is there another position that would work that they can then move their people around? Or if there is no work, then there's into a layoff process, at which point you say the person with the most seniority and you get down into the bumping rights at that point in time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, I think to that point, I just have had two people return to DAS over the year that I've been there under this particular policy. And basically, you take a look at what is the person's skill set, what did they do before for you, and what jobs that you have open, and where would they make a good fit. Because if they worked for you and they promoted up, chances are they were one of your star employees, and you're pretty glad to have them back. They have good skill sets. They've had other experience. So, you know, within DAS itself, we have had a need for those talents, and we put those folks to work. One of them went back to the exact same position that they promoted up out of about 3 years ago, and another person has a different type of job, but it was a position we had open at the time. I think if a manager running an agency doesn't have a position open, then you actually are looking at a layoff process, basically. Mm-hmm. And you need to go through those steps. So there's no need for you managing the agency to have somebody that you're not putting to productive use.
Mr. Chair, Shane, can I follow up my final? I want to ask another question beyond this. Essentially, what happens is once a state employee, always a state employee, because it becomes your God-given right to go back from anyone, anywhere you want without having to go through the hiring process. So it makes it extraordinarily difficult for those, because you're guaranteed a job. You have the right to go back.
Mr. Representative Kitz, I wouldn't depict it that way. Many of these people,
without cause, and there are, and I understand that cause supersedes.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, if they're not performing, then they're not. You know, they have to go through a termination process. But I mean, you spend a lot of money investing in people, training them, knowing your systems, working with them over time. So it's really a better use of your dollars and your time to put people to work that have worked for you if they've been good employees. I don't think it's necessarily their right, but I think it's in interest of the state and the public to utilize that resource that you've spent time growing and maturing. That some of those people don't opt to bump back or restore back. They say, hey, I can get a better job somewhere else, and they do. So that's why, you know, over the last few years period of time, Sue, in talking with HR managers, basically found we had about 12 individuals. Now, they, you know, wanted to make their career in state government, obviously, but there's other people that chose to go to private sector or other governments. So,
and Mr. Chair, is it the will of the chair? I would ask that we not move this bill today, and possibly put it on the agenda for Friday. But whenever if the chair puts the bill back on the agenda, if DAS could provide for this committee the number of employees, let's say over the last 10 years, that have been terminated, I don't want names, just the number that have been terminated for cause.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, and that's I think that's a very good point, and I want to do that. I know that there is an urban legend that once you are a state employee, you are always a state employee. However, I spend a great deal of my time assisting agencies in removing people for cause. If it's not working, managers are trying to move out people who can't perform. And I spend a great deal of time on that, much, much more than I do in anything related to restoration and people being unwilling and unable. So I just want to clarify that is indeed happening.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Holman, do you have a question?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm very concerned that this bill really does take away some ability of our state government to utilize its best resources. And, you know, I think from what I've heard and what I've read, I think this bill is a step in the wrong direction. I don't think that we're creating jobs for people when we restore them if, as they've indicated, if there's no position, it triggers a layoff situation. So, you know, I'm really worried that this bill will make it impossible for our state agencies to keep some of its best people.
Could I'm not clear just exactly what your amendments do. What does the amendment do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendments are in the event that the bill is going to pass out of committee and you're wanting to send it on. We have concerns if it comes out in its current state that we have a conflict within the bill. What we end up with is two different standards for removal, and yet currently there's two different standards because there's two different consequences. One has restoration, the other is your out-of-state service. And working with the attorneys, having two different standards for removal for management service doesn't serve us well and will create conflict and probably some more legal issues and court time. So what we would like to do is to then make it so that there's only one standard for removal of management service, and that would be for cause.
Thank you. Thank you much for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 638. And Janet, is there anything else on the agenda?
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Janet.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Shoffler would like.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I'd move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Shoffler to vote on Senate Bill. He already voted on Senate Bill 15. Senate Bill 585, and if he wants the opportunity to change his vote on Senate Bill 15, more than happy to.
And 323.
Oh, and Senate Bill 323. Thank you, Representative Holby.
Representative Kitts moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of letting Representative Shoffler vote on Senate Bill 585 and Senate Bill 323. Is there any objection?
And Senate Bill 15, Mr. Chair.
You already voted on once. I'm not going to let you change your vote.
But if you'd like to change your vote, give me, Mr. Chair.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Shoffler, how do you vote on Senate Bill 585?
Aye.
And on Senate Bill 323?
Aye, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that,
15, you want to change that?
No, I already.
Right. Anything else, Janet?
Clear as mud.
Okay. With that, we're adjourned now.
Well.